Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, the place of the site of technical subtlety and the conversation with Masons. Today, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in. And thank you. My goodness, I have to be grateful. And I know you find this tedious, regular to listeners. But you know, I don't think it hurts, and it's good manners to show a bit of gratitude. Listeners, hello. I won't thank you this time. I will say hello to listeners in Ireland. Hello, hello, hello. Japan, hello. Very, very nice to have you sitting in. New Zealand, it's always, always fun to just think about, you know, you're on the, you're sort of the counterpoint. I'm here in Canada, up here. You're up there in enjoying the sunshine right now. And China, always a pleasure. Zambia, yes, of course. What's happening? What's not happening? And South Sudan and Ethiopia, the whole continent is becoming more and more well represented in our listening audience. And why shouldn't it? It's taking its place. Look at the growth. Look at the change that's happening, particularly along the coast. I mean, well, we won't get into that here, but remarkable, remarkable. And Oman, moving off into areas where there's such an intensity of idealism. We have listeners from Pakistan. Often, and I will say this in all candor, I'm so pleased that you feel that Masonic Effects has some value to you. But there's so many questions, so much about Pakistan that just remains waiting for us. And to have a Balkan state, Latvia sitting in, it speaks to itself. Old culture and somebody there are listeners that are joining this group across the way over there. They're closer. They live closer to Lionel Messi. You know, the World Cup, this year's World Cup will be remembered not for some of the silliness, the politics of the site, but for the amazing, amazing talent of this fellow. It's like, you know, sometimes things fall into place. And was there anyone that didn't want him to have a victory at a World Cup as he moved into the latter stages of his career? Just a joy to watch and to be... USA, what taking its place within its own skin, I think the change is happening on different levels at the same time and on display. It's like this was a script written for me. The next group of listeners that seem to pull in, that do pull in regularly, are from the United Kingdom. And I don't even know how to, to be honest, I'm not being trying to be cute or frivolous here, but to begin to, from this distance, 6,000 kilometers away, to begin to try and understand what in the world is going on. I'm not the only one doing that. I'm not the only one. In a place, and here I am sitting in a place where for a very long time, from the beginning, our government has information from us in open display. We've been gaslighted so often. And yet there's an upside, you know, to this paternalism. Did people that were designing big projects saw a need for stability, create something really quite interesting? Yes. And that now it seems that it's run, part of it's run the course. The beauty is that we're still a beautiful and huge, huge nation, as you know. And we're coming to grips with individual responsibility. So I often think, maybe I'm silly, I often think that the Athenians were onto something. Every one of us has a responsibility, and requires input. Our system isn't set up that way. It's very top down, but we're getting there. We're getting there, and largely, and I'm not shy about admitting it. Largely, it's because we have some very, very brilliant, brilliant women in this country that are moving forward, and so I sit here grateful for, on so many different levels, for being fortunate enough to be in this country. And where I am, we are welcoming hundreds of thousands of new people every year, coming from there, from wherever you are, to take root and searching for the opportunity, and to share not only this landscape, but the quality of life that exists here. And it doesn't exist because we're acquiescent or we're good little sheep. It exists, and we're growing more and more impatient, and more our expectations are changing. So times are changing. Wherever we are, times have always changed, and it's a pleasure. So of course, I just need to acknowledge, and I kind of get it. I think it's kind of interesting, and I don't know when I'll ever stop doing that. That we have a program like this, it has a footprint, however deep. I hope we don't leave too much of a damage on the global environment, but a footprint around the world. And I would can imagine if we had a chance to sit in one room just to have this conversation. But a pleasure to be with you, sitting in too, and. So much going on. I hardly know where to begin. I'm fascinated. Do you notice that things are? We have a habit of focusing on unproductive. Aspects of the craft, and I want to just try and put I mean that in all sincerity. I want to try and put that into perspective. The state that we're in today, does it make sense to you? Let me just put the question out there for you. Does it make sense to you that masonry is an ideal? And yes, we could discuss that it's not just an ideal, but it is an ideal, but so much more, because it's been articulated it's nuance. It's been observed, and you know, when we're encouraged to be observers, careful observers, quiet, astute, pensive observers, we are bound to notice things, and we have. It is an ideal at which, by definition, means it will always be just beyond our grasp. But we look at us. We are so many men in pursuit of that ideal. Let's not spend too much time on the struggle that we have. Each one of us, however many there are around the world, that's an espresso, by the way. Around the world, we don't start with shined shoes and coiffed hair. We are what we are. When we go home, we spend, we practice our masonry outside the lodge. We learn it in the lodge, but like you, we practice it outside the lodge, real life. And that is certainly, I think it gives, maybe if I'm speaking to cynics out there, it gives cynics a bit of satisfaction to try and blanket the world with these statements that, you know, everybody's a bit corrupted or those kind of statements, you know, looking at it. And how do you defend that? Well, it's just, if that's the way you think, I can't imagine Freemasons lingering over that, but it's certainly a consideration. Are we, but we don't use the word inadequate. I think we use a more polite and perhaps more penetrating term. This pursuit of the ideal is humbling. It's humbling. We never plant our nationalist flag and say, "There, we've accomplished it. We've conquered it." There is Hiram. Is this what? It's composite, isn't it? Of us, of man, of humanity. And I think for me, that's some of the richness and beauty of it. As we then begin to learn, you know, if you're fortunate enough, somebody will talk with you about that mutual commitment, the commitment to each other, not only the commitment to the ideal, but we need to be more than an idea. When I was a boy, one of those careers you go through as you're moving through life, I worked on high steel. Can you imagine? I can't now. Up in the air, high steel, in steel mills here in Ontario, and we had a sense that we were building something important. What we were building was then New Age. It was filtering contaminants out of the air, way before people. This was popular conversation. But we were always, learning something new technology, and applying it. The idea, one of the lessons from that was from a beautiful old English man that sort of took me in under his wing. I was the new kind of guy on the crew, and he was a lion of a huge man, but very very thoughtful man. And I'm trying to remember his name right now, but I can remember his face. Every day at lunch, the boys would head off to a local tavern. They would just beetle on. We didn't have a long lunch, but they would just speed out of the lot of one steel mill down there. It wasn't very long, but you could fill a pickup truck full of boys and construction crew and head. There was a bit of imbibing going on in the bar. The draft was very, very, very cheap and cold and delicious. And so that's where the planning would. He told me that's where the planning happens. when the boys are in their cups and they are building bridges. And that's where they would talk about the building bridges. They weren't doing anything. They were sitting there happily and pixelated. But that's what they were doing, building bridges in their minds. We can't do that, eh? Masonry, that ideal that we have, that search for the progressive thinker, the worldly and analysis of consciousness. We need action. Yeah, it's not just the cabal that helps us understand this, but more than the mind, we need to put the ideas into action in order to fulfill the mandate. Us, we watch ourselves. Some of our projects are just remarkable. Some, as you would expect, some are incredibly imaginative and forward thinking. So line us all up. Why? Line us all up. And all those who who have the a talent of a Picasso or a Monet or a Michelangelo or a Colbert or Shakespeare, step forward. Just one pace forward. And no slight, but all of you, if you have the talent of Mozart or Haydn or Tchaikovsky or the penmanship of the pen of Tolstoy, step forward, please, or Melville, or you can see that those are remarkable. They're us. They're men, huh? But they're remarkable. They have talent, and we assume that they have a natural talent, but it dismisses the fact that most of those people work very, very, all of them work very, very hard to develop their skill. They were craftsmen, and they were the entered apprentice that the master builder killed because the work was so beyond what the master builder could produce. And out of what would it be, avarice? I don't know. Silly pride. He killed the boy. So we have those men around us, although we might not know them at the time. As you live through life, you find that the guy down the street, well, that he ended up, or that young woman down the street, they ended up quite famous. And yet I was in class with them. They seemed kind of normal. They seemed kind of shy, or they were always being beaten up because they were odd. They were being weird. Boys being boys, we seem to inherit the sense of tragedy and stupidity and just write it off as boys being boys. That's boys that haven't been taught respect, respect for themselves or to respect the uniqueness of other people. So when I line us all up around the globe, we're a big crowd. But if you are amongst those people that I've mentioned, just take one step forward. That does not mean that those that are still in line are in any way inferior. Like, give us credit that when you put down your brushes, and I go to the gallery to see your work, or I I'm in the theater, I'm in the globe, and there's what am I listening to? Henry IV. Okay, I can admire beauty, and if I'm fortunate enough to have acquired the tastes of the culture, the best parts of the culture, of course, the music and the dance and the theater is going to be part of that, of course, and my theater may well be the beauty of a stream or a sunrise in early morning sunrise where it's still the mist is coming off the lakes. And you remember that smell. And here around the world, we have a park called Algonquin. And it is extremely good for the heart and soul just to be in those moments. It does not mean that everything else is inferior. It simply means that we have a mind that's capable of appreciating beauty. I tend to think that appreciation is very widespread but kept secret. I do. Because the boys that haven't been taught how to be confident with their taste, we'll be shy. They'll be, you know, of course they'll be shy. What are they left with? That's the way they were raised. Yeah. But as Freemasons, as one of us, they're allowed to explore. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. We're allowed to explore. And if we develop a taste that is unusual, it's not popular, it's not what the boys would prefer. Well, we've been taught well to keep quiet about that kind of thing, and it doesn't stop us. It's like that Englishman, an Englishman on the construction crew, just loved opera. Well, you know, when you're a giant of a man of your certain age, you can say and you can love whatever that you want. The rest, just to, you know, you can love something without the stupidity around you. You don't have to invite that. And that's, I think, what a lot of Masons around here, there's still that the consummate shyness and about identifying the taste and so. Self-improvement is still a ways, it's still off there in the distant future and of course it probably is around you too. Fortunately, we can open up discussions in such a wide variety of topics and maybe I wonder if this is one of the things that's made the estates a bit uneasy about masonry, particularly in the early days, because it does encourage that independent observation, not so much foolishness, not stupidity. My goodness, no. You can do that on your own. You don't need us, and you certainly shouldn't be putting on an apron when you're in that frame of mind. It's not a thing ourselves. It's not binary. As one fellow, you know, last year was trying to convince me, he thinks sees the world in binary terms. I think, my goodness, what implanted that notion in a boy's mind? And the world is black and white. It's so much more. It's that plus so much more. We're coming to terms with that. I every day in our own way. The trends, as we pull back, I think some of the trends in what's happening with our orders and with an order like Freemasonry has something to do with the expansion and shrinkage of the middle class and the remoteness and isolation of the upper class and the redefinition of classless societies. The world is evolving and people want the opportunity. They want that lifestyle that they see over there. And it comes with such protectionism that it requires predictability and stability and safety. And that's something that a lot of people don't have. They don't feel it. So the people listening in, I presume that you have that sense of safety and curiosity. And of course, I do respect that every listener to Masonic Effects is expert, certainly far more expert than the likes of me. But I think, but maybe if you allow me to ask some of those naughty questions that you know, in certain circles, ought not to be not to be entertained. The rights of individuals. Where do we start? Where do we begin? Do we begin that conversation with in a quarrelsome kind of a frame of mind? I'll leave you with this thought that it's still interesting when we're together to focus on to listen to and understand you rather than listen to react. That is that anticipation that if somebody asks a question, we feel compelled to blurt out an answer. And often that's what it is, a reaction. We're just blurting out an answer because it feels it's social convention. And so to be polite, we're going to say something. Is it the refinement of your thinking? Well, no, of course not. It's the first thing. Let's not have any of those awkward moments. But what happens in masonry is we're asked that question, like, why are you just filling in the blank there? Well, what in the world is wrong with the silence? Darn that Pythagoras. What's wrong with the silence? Hey, I think you'll enjoy the program today. I know I enjoyed pulling it. We enjoyed pulling it together. The progress of change, masonry takes root. Let that be a theme for you. And the poetry, what could be better? Sonnet 15. Oh, scurry over to your bookshelves in the interlude. We're going to have some really remarkable music starting in just a second. Shakespeare's sonnet, When I Consider Everything That Grows. Oh, of course. And sit back and enjoy. And it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
John Coltrane to introduce the show. Nice work. Here, tell me what you think of this. Does this make sense? Frankly, I like differences. Maybe it is because familiarity. Maybe it is because friction makes an otherwise tedious existence much more challenging. 8 billion of us bring 8 billion perspectives into play. If you allow all those perspectives combined, will reveal truths, you know, amongst them. The combination is clarity and accuracy. Today, the news is full of concerns about our future. It confuses us by turning to selling news that makes money to pay bills. If only news would flag each item according to motivation, like why are we presenting this to you? We think it will appeal to the reptilian mind and therefore we'll sell you product. It would help to know if something is newsworthy because it appeals to the senses. Slowly, our dignity eroded. Death by a thousand cuts. Propriety is left to the wealthy. The masses have been seduced by salaciousness, exposed so often it is not even noticed. Vulgarity and shock gained attention in an impersonal media. We traded mouth to ear for that efficiency. We called it freedom. Change has always been with us. Today, we are learning about the universe as a place constantly in motion. Along with our own curiosity, we're challenged by others wanting to gain our attention for their reasons. The fatigue has been generational and more insidious than simple advertisement. We are being manipulated as far as we want to be, and sometimes we're not aware. That's what the apron does for us. We select what is or is not relevant after studying what ought to be relevant. So says the overview of 5,000 years of philosophical argument being taught to you and me. I begin to think we are at the seam between mathematics on one hand and its philosophical match on the other, in a delightful liminal state. I know that's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? A liminal state is fraught. Are we born curious, some more than others? Are we so confident of our findings that we can be the observer and not a participant? I'll let you know. Something to think about. What think you? This next tune is about something very powerful that troubles us. It's about falling in love. Terrible. Except we can't live without it.
Thank you.
Why poetry? Why Shakespeare? Today, I wanted something that went with, you complemented the theme, and I can't tell you that I've been through the whole, all of the works of Shakespeare. So you'll hear that. You'll hear bits of his work, and perhaps more often than other poets. Why do people, it's not only why we like, why we enjoy Shakespeare after hundreds of years. What was he, 15th century? Here's just a brief description that I think captures it so beautifully. His plays, and the question, why do people love Shakespeare? Well, his plays give us the greatest sense of the value of human life and of how people live or how people love or the importance of human relationships. And he does it in a way that's different than other writers of his time or any other time. And his plays are so popular because just because he is perhaps the greatest writer who ever lived. Now, and his work has been translated, so if we're thinking that you have to read it in a particular, no, the message, that kind of, those kind of core messages come across in all languages. To think, my barrier, and I don't think it's alone, was to think through and be curious about it. If somebody says that this is the greatest, it's like somebody handed me, Middlemarch. I went out and bought a copy of Middlemarch. This is the greatest novel ever written. Well, I have to take a look at that for myself. So I went into my local used bookshop many, many years ago and bought a copy. Do you think it's like Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter? Do you think that I can get through that? Oh, it's... There's other things that, give me a copy of Melville or Cervantes, or just jump into it. Tolstoy, you don't jump, you savor that. But this Middlemarch just escapes me. Then it's still on my desk. It's still on my bookshelf. It will be read. Here, I wanted access. Do I have, what's the big deal? What's the appeal? And it's in a language that it isn't spoken today. Well, the language that he's writing in wasn't spoken in his day either. But it captures the essence of ideas, and we can, it allows us to relate to them. If you're looking at deception or unrequited love or passion or murder, it's all there. It's stark, but it's done. It's not done with a stick. It's done with the lightest of brush strokes. Fifteenth Odyssey. Sonnet 15. This is in this one, he's surveying objects, and he's talking about how they mutate, how they decay over time. Me too. Everything that grows holds in perfection, but a little moment. I like it because it fits with it. I don't know if it's a theme, but it's the reality that everything's in motion all the time. So if I said to you, things are changing, well, how could they not? Everything's in motion. Stick your little hands out in front of you and realize that there's neutrinos blasting through you and me and everything around us. And I'm not sure if they travel the same speed as light. So it took 8 minutes for them to get to the surface of the earth. The sun to us, but they're blasting through us. Are we tragically upset about that, or do we note that every day? No, personally, but it's kind of interesting to know everything's in motion, and even the youth's beauty will fade over time. Well, not only has youth's beauty faded, but there's something that's come between my youthful figure and the edge of the desk. I wasn't expecting this, but there it is. Yeah, something's come and the fade. The poet knows that this metamorphosis is inevitable, and he gains an even stronger appreciation of a young man's beautiful appearance in the present time, at least in the present time within the sonnet. So ironically, then, the youth's beauty is both transitory and permanent. Transitory because all things in nature mutate and decay over, we change. And permanent because the inevitable aging process. And the poet here, Shakespeare, is totally aware of this inevitability, and it intensifies the young man's present beauty. It's like that, when you just savor that moment as the sun sets, it's going to set, but it's so, maybe, and we're saying here, that's what makes it so beautiful. it enhances. And generally, the more momentary an object lasts, the more vibrant and intense is its short lifespan. You can do this in a sonnet. But it introduces another major theme that will be greatly developed. He talks about later, the power of the poet's verse to memorialize forever that beauty. I engraft you new. The poet says at the end of the sonnet, which, and however steady is the charge of change, the verses about the young man will keep the youth's beauty always fresh, always new. And the sonnets immortalize this beauty. So is it ironic that the poet's sonnet served the same purpose as a son whom the poet wants the young man to father? I suppose you could say the same thing about women, couldn't you? He happens to be writing about a young man. And this perpetuates the youth's beauty. I don't know if doing that, it's kind of meager to say you're competing or you're bitter about it. So in a way, the sonnet's even more immortal than a son. The sonnet continues to be read even today. The young man's progeny have completely died out, maybe. We don't know. We don't know. Here. When I consider everything that grows, holds in perfection but a little moment, that this huge stage presenteth not but shows, whereon the stars in secret influence comment. When I perceive that men as plants increase, cheered and checked even by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory, then the conceit of this inconstant stay sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay, and to change your day of youth to sullied night, and all in war with time for love of you. As he takes from you, I engraft you new. The battle with time, eh? Time takes, but I don't have to. My, oh my. Thank you, Bill Shakespeare. Thank you. Pretty amazing. It's Stan Getz. I want to talk today. It's interesting that history reveals. It's interesting what it reveals, and it's interesting how it reveals it. We're talking about a conversation going on about some tensions happening in The Hague about the purity of the ideas of masonry and whether they're gender bound, whether there's a gender bias that is a barrier in a way to accessing the philosophical notions, the foundations of masonry. You've heard me talk about at different times about this. But here is something that I think reveals a certain, maybe, I don't know if she does this all the time, but Margaret Jacob, I think, really hit on something quite interesting. She's quite an observant writer. And I want to appreciate this. I'll go through this. And this is about, we've just heard a discourse. This fellow Saint-Dien manages a rhetorical exist from the gender exclusivity of the traditional lodges. So the idea here is that we're talking about rhetoric, the skill that I think every Mason deserves to learn, because it is the difference between being overbearing and being influential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to be, it's something that we can perfect. Being overbearing and thuggish, nobody needs to, you know, we have that all the time. And often to get our attention, somebody is whistling or screaming or yelling, you know, that kind of stuff. Not so around us. He or she simply is sitting back with us, and we're just thinking it through. And here, she's thinking this through. We've listened to this discourse and to the rhetoric, and it's beautiful. And, you know, rhetoric, it's not what you and I, what position we're thinking. It's the idea. We're going to talk about it from both sides, both sides. We're going to see the world through the eyes of others who don't necessarily agree with our own view. That's one way of putting it. But as she points out, that the discourse, the discussions, are an example of the resourcefulness of Masonic rhetoric in justifying digressions from social convention, or in articulating departures from conventional moral or religious wisdom. To me, that struck me as something quite interesting. Our capacity to articulate and to the way we frame our discussions allows us to talk about the sacred cows. No offense meant. Talks allows us to talk about things that by convention we ought not to talk about, or we're taught, you know, the rules of engagement. And once placed in the temple of virtue, as she puts it, compelled by the primitive light, hermetically sealed. Well, we won't get into the impact of Hermes and Thoth and Kabbalah, not here. Sealed from the ignorant and the profane.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So is this all self-evident? No. You need to understand, and to do that, you need to do the work. You know, it's like learning to create that perfect ashlar. You want to sit back and watch the master do it for you? No. We'll show you the tools, show you what we need, and then have at it. So it's compelled by this primitive light. That's what we're aiming for, and it's primitive. Brothers could define the profane, that's you and I, and then join with sisters in this discussion to seek the perfection of the Masonic work. Paradoxically, yeah, listen to this, mystical language permitted reason to be invoked in defiance of tradition and social convention. Once conjured up in the service of virtue, reason permitted Masons to argue for the universal path, the universal truth, and applicability of their actions. See? Once conjured up in the service of virtue. So we're talking about things that are trigger words and ideas that were, you know, provocative. Only we're doing it boldly. Not overbearing, but we're doing it, and we're calling it, calling up the our work in the virtue, in the service of virtue, and in the service of virtue we're discussing. So that's the context. And how are you going to? And we're able to articulate what that means, what we mean by it. Who would oppress us, and who would challenge us, and who would censor us for doing it? It's the search for through the virtue, and yet barriers against other profanes remained. Masonic idealism bore little relation to the real barriers to membership that income or the absence of surplus wealth must have presented. Admission to Les Loges du Juste was a costly matter, more costly than admission to most other lodges. Aside from the gold-plated jewelry depicting the sun and the moon and the masters and mistresses wore, silk and taffeta accessories were also part of a member's basic attire. Like all European Freemasons, the brothers and sisters embraced the symbols of the workman's uniform. But in rendering their aprons in taffeta and their gloves in silk, they also symbolically repudiated the sweat, dirt, and hard work that is the lot of the worker. At the Comédie Française, where so many of the brothers and sisters were employed, a stagehand with some technical skill who arranged the scenery between acts was paid a little over 6 guilders a day for 4 days of work in 1752. Since the company performed irregularly, that sum could not be expected on a daily basis. In the same year, the best seat in the theater cost 3 guilders. Although places were available for less than a guilder, in 1750, a worker in the Shipbuilders Guild at Amsterdam, one of the most highly remunerated in the Republic, could hope to earn 1.4 guilders a day. Unfortunately, the actual income of any one of the actors or actresses cannot be determined from available records because they negotiated for space and other necessities as a company, and they divided up the profits equally amongst themselves. We do know that the actors and actresses of this prestigious troupe lived well and kept servants. And at this time, a good actor on the Amsterdam stage could earn up to 1,000 guilders a year. It's like so many things in masonry, the metaphor, the allegories, the mention of rhetoric, liberal sciences, antiquity, allows us to safely observe and explore the values of life. Even the things we conventionally and socially ought not to explore. It makes me think that for example, in the period that the author, this writer, this historian is talking about, the social strata was itself a screen, a filter to who had access to Freemasonry. When you see her descriptions of a wage, working in a shipbuilder's yard, 1.3, 1.5 guilders a day, being an actor, but or being a stagehand, you could make 2 or 3 guilders a day, but it wasn't perfect. It wasn't every day. So it wasn't reliable. Well, today we don't have those screens aren't so available because disposable income has changed. Education has changed. It's not just it's not the elite. It's still in a way it's a elite, but it's not just controlled by the elite. It's not for the children of the wealthy or the clergy, as it once was. It was more prevalent in this period. It brings to mind that those in those lodges where we had illiteracy, Masons were very skilled, but not necessarily literate. We also had the growth of speculative Masons, and more of the gentry and the mercantile class that were educated. And it wasn't a competition. It wasn't a ladder. They passed on their learning, their reading, their access to libraries and education to other members of the lodge as equals in discussion. They didn't treat the other members of the lodge as inferiors. But then again, we're not looking at, we're not necessarily thinking that the lodges were a reflection of social stratification. Certainly not. But we had that exchange. And today, I find that it still we have people with advanced life skills and education, and we have others that because of their own circumstance aren't as articulate, aren't as accomplished, and yet very eager to be assisted, to accept the assistance, not as superior subordinate, no, certainly not, but for the exchange of valuable information. Can an illiterate man sit in the audience at the Globe Theater and laugh and cry, become upset at the play? Well, of course. So something to think about. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I've certainly enjoyed presenting it to you again. I look forward to having you sit in next week for another episode. I'm thinking that we ought to get into something about the rethinking our heroes. You know, we don't have the same grasp of hero worship and I think I'll dig out some of Campbell's work to help me with that one. But I do appreciate it that you're here. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness, please. And if you are out there and anonymous and I walk past you, share the love. Share the love. And doing those deeds that benefit people around with no sense of, without courting applause. I love that. I love that about Masonry. I'll leave you with Herb Ellis to close the show off, but commit acts of random Masonic kindness and do include yourself. Bye for now. Thank you. treat good ones nice. Thank you.